Ladies and gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen, I think we'll start. I know the LSE is always fashionably late for its lectures to begin, but this seems about right. Those of you with very good eyesight will notice that I'm not Gavin Davis. I'm Frances Cairncross, and I chair the Economic and Social Research Council, which funds the Centre for Economic Performance, of which Richard Layard is co-director and major luminary. And I'm here to introduce him and to introduce this series of three lectures. This is the 19th in the series, the 19th series of Lionel Robbins lectures. Earlier speakers have been very grand indeed. We've had Rudi Dornbusch and Paul Krugman, among others, and three Nobel Prize winners. This year's series is the LSE's own Richard Layard, talking about a subject that I think is of enormous interest to all of us. How could it not be? The ESRC is very keen on cross-disciplinary research, as you all know, and I've always thought that the best cross-disciplinary research emerges when economists tackle subjects that some might say are none of their business. And happiness, at first glance, seems to be one of these. When the dismal science gets to grips with happiness, then you have real cross-disciplinary work at hand. Richard has been rather good at this sort of thing. He first wrote on happiness back in the 1970s. His work since then has been on areas like inequality and unemployment, and has helped to win the centre a Queen's Prize for Higher Education a couple of weeks ago, which was very splendid. What he's going to look at tonight, I think, is a question that Jeremy Bentham would probably have asked, which is whether the objective of social science should be to increase human happiness. If he finds that the answer is yes, I hope that he'll come up with a bit of evidence-based policy in one of the three lectures that he's giving tonight. It would be much easier for me to argue the case for grants for social science research and promote the public image of the social sciences if the ESRC could guarantee that it would contribute to not just to national wealth, but also to national content. So in this first lecture tonight, Richard's going to talk about the nature of happiness and its progress in the last half century. Even happiness makes progress. In the second lecture tomorrow night, he's going to look at why we haven't been getting happier than we have been in spite of our increased affluence. And then in the third, I hope he will draw some policy implications. So, ladies and gentlemen, happiness is Richard Layard.
Well, Frances, thank you very much. This is not a funding proposal, but it's an important subject, and I'm really happy to be giving these lectures to so many old and new friends, in particular because they are in memory of Lionel Robbins, who I had the enormous good fortune of working for when I was young and impressionable. One of my first jobs was working for the Committee on Higher Education, which he was the chairman of, and it was a great experience for me, and he very kindly said it was a great experience for him. I was surprised when looking in his autobiography just now to see he actually describes it as one of the most rewarding experiences he had working with Klaus Moser and myself. And I still feel exactly the same. What was remarkable when I think back to him was how whatever you were discussing, it always felt like a voyage of discovery. And before evidence-based policy had been invented, he was practicing it. That's what I remember him for. However, in these lectures, I'm going to be taking a very different line to the one which he took on the subject of happiness. And I want to go into a little intellectual history to set the scene for these lectures. Can everybody hear? Please wave if you can't. Now, as you know, in the 18th century, Bentham and others proposed that the object of public policy should be to maximize the sum of happiness in society. So economics evolved as the study of utility, otherwise known as happiness. And it was assumed for most of the 19th century that this was in principle both measurable and capable of being compared across people. And it was also assumed that the extra pound was less valuable to the rich man than the poor man in terms of happiness, so that income should be redistributed up to the point where the efficiency cost outweighed that gain. And all of this was challenged by Lionel Robbins in his famous book, which he wrote here, On the Nature and Significance of Economic Science in 1932. Now, Robbins argued correctly that if your basic aim was to predict how a person would respond to a change in their situation, you need only assume that the person has a stable set of preferences. You don't have to concern yourself with the person's happiness level, doesn't have to be measurable, nor is there any need for you to be able to compare one person's happiness with another's. Moreover, the focus which Robbins gave to our subject was, in his famous definition, that economics was about the relationship between given ends and scarce means. I just repeat the phrase, given ends. And economics was not to try and explain how people came to have the ends which they did. That was taken as given, and if somebody was to explain it, it wasn't an economist to think about it. So that was to be the agenda of positive economics as defined by Robbins, and actually it's remained like that to this day. So where does public policy come in? Now, Robbins himself was not averse to mixing in the public debate, but he didn't believe that optimal public policy could be analysed within a formal economic framework. But so he founded this wonderful economics department here, which has been most of my life, and wonderful it is. But in that department, the people he inspired at the time in the 30s went beyond Robbins when they started trying to formalise the theory of economic policy. And we had here two rather different people, Hicks and Kaldor, who both proposed a very similar measure of national welfare. And what was it? Well, it was, roughly speaking, the GDP adjusted for leisure and pollution and a few other things. And some economists have objected to this and tried to pursue a different line of thought called public economics, and I'll say something about that in my last lecture. But the majority of economists, when they talk about policy, have been more or less content to think about what the result will be in terms of its impact on the GDP, adjusted for a few things like leisure and pollution. But of course, the main point of these lectures is that GDP is a hopeless measure of welfare. Since the war, the GDP has shot up by leaps and bounds, but as I shall show, the happiness of the population has stagnated. So if we want to understand how the economy actually affects our well-being, we have to use psychology as well as economics. But fortunately, psychology has made strong moves in the right direction in recent decades, and I'm hoping that economics will follow. Maybe these lectures will give a prod. Now, what is interesting is that psychology, like economics under the influence of Robbins, went through a very behaviorist phase in the early 20th century, actually before economics. Going a bit further back into the 19th century, psychologists were thinking about feelings, William James, people like that. But then along came Pavlov, followed by Skinner, and these people argued that we can never know what other people are feeling. You often hear this said, that was what they argued, and that therefore all we can think about is how they behave. At that time, of course, behavior was largely attributed to conditioning, and you may know the story about how Skinner's students decided to test his theories. When he was lecturing, he used to walk up and down on the platform. So they all decided that when he was at the left-hand side, they would sort of look down and frown and look miserable. When he got to the right-hand side, they'd all look up and smile. And eventually they had him teetering on the extreme extreme right-hand end of the platform. So, behaviorism was the intellectual climate of the 30s, and it's not surprising that economics followed that credo. But as I said, in the last 20 years or so, psychologists have returned in strength to the study of feelings, measuring them, comparing them across people, explaining them. And anthropologists, I think, have also concluded, or some anthropologists, that there are important universals in human nature so that you can make comparisons between people, because if you couldn't, actually, it's difficult to imagine how we could understand each other if we really didn't have any idea what we were feeling. So I think the time is now ripe for policy to revert to its task of maximizing the sum of human well-being, and it can be based on a steadily improving social science. So what I want to do in these lectures is to develop a picture of that project. I think it has to be called project these days, an intellectual endeavor, and present some initial conclusions. So what I'm going to do is this. In the first lecture, I'm going to discuss the nature and measurement of happiness and provide lots of evidence that despite economic growth, happiness in the West has not grown in the last 50 years. In the second lecture, as Francis said, I shall ask why that's so, despite the huge increase in living standards, and I will draw some conclusions about the efficient level of taxation. And in the third lecture, I shall discuss what other policies would really produce a better quality of life, ending with a rousing defense of Benthamite philosophy, as Francis challenged me to, because of course that is what motivates the whole endeavor. Okay. So, what do I mean by happiness? By happiness, I mean feeling good, enjoying life, feeling it's wonderful. And by unhappiness, I mean feeling bad and wishing things were different. And I believe that there is a continuum from one end of the scale to the other. There are, of course, countless sources of happiness and countless sources of pain and misery. But all our experience, and this is my argument and I'll substantiate it a bit, all our experience has in it a dimension which corresponds to how good or bad we feel. And in fact, most people find it easy to say how good they're feeling, and in social surveys, such questions get 99% response rates, which is much higher than the average response rate to those types of questionnaire. I want to stress the point about a single dimension and a single variable, and encourage you to think of other things that seem to have different qualities, but in fact have a single cardinal measure. Let's take noise, for example. There are all kinds of noise. The trombone, there's the cat caterwauling, but these all have decibels. They can all be measured, how loud or soft they are, decibels. There are different types of pain. There's toothache, there's tummy ache, but you can compare them and say which is worse, and you can compare different modes of enjoyment. And going on, as I shall show, happiness and unhappiness are not separate dimensions like this. They run into each other, and there is a continuum. Now, that was what Bentham thought. That was how he talked about these things. And, of course, a generation afterwards, John Stuart Mill muddied the waters, because he argued that there were the two dimensions of happiness. There was the quantity and the quality. But psychologists have not been able to identify a separate qualitative dimension. And I think, really, what Mill was talking about, or should have been talking about, and he was certainly onto something, he should have been saying that there are different causes and sources of happiness, some of which produce very short-lived effects, therefore not very important, and some which produce the enduring effects which he thought were worthy. Now, obviously, just to make that distinction, people's feelings do fluctuate from hour to hour and from day to day. And using people's own reports, psychologists have begun to study that. And I think it's instructive to begin with that, even if we're going to end up with what the underlying average is. And I want to give you an example from a study of around 1,000 working women in Texas. They were asked to divide the previous day into episodes, rather like a film. Typically they identified about 15 of these episodes, and then for each episode they were asked to write down what they were, or to say what they were doing, and who they were doing it with, and how they felt during the episode. And there were various dimensions along which they reported their feelings, which were combined into a single index. And this first table shows what they liked most, and what they liked least. Moving down a bit from the top, you can see that they also very much liked socializing and relaxing, and they didn't very much like work or going to it or from it. The second table shows what company they most enjoyed. You can see they were very gregarious. They preferred almost any company to being alone. Only the boss's company was worse than being alone. So presumably there was very little sex with the boss. We can also use these reports to measure how feelings change as the day goes on. This is interesting. This corresponds to my experience. I don't know about you. As the day goes on, people feel better, except for a dip after lunch. And they also feel more tired as the day goes on. Tiredness doesn't make you miserable. They relax as they get tired, there's only one period when they start perking up a bit, which is just about now. But the most striking finding of the study, which I'm not going to show a picture of, is not these short-term fluctuations, but the huge difference, whatever the activity, between different people. And it's this underlying happiness and its determinants, which of course we have to focus on and which these lectures are about. And what we really want to understand, I want to be very clear on this, is the average level of happiness which a person feels when averaged over a very long period of their life and experience. But before going on, I want to be the devil's advocate and ask the question, do these feelings that people report actually correspond to any kind of objective reality? This question, which was doubted in the early part of last century. Because we absolutely need to know that when people say they're feeling something, there is a corresponding event which has some objective reality. Otherwise, we might as well give up the subject. I believe the situation has changed enormously with the growth of neuroscience, and we now know for sure that there is an objective event that corresponds to the feeling of happiness. But the feelings which people report when they say they feel happy correspond closely to activities in the brain, which we can now measure from instant to instant. And this relationship is important, very, very important to us for two reasons. First, the correlation between what people say and what is going on in the brain applies over time within each individual, and you can do experiments and monitor that, which provides a solid basis for the notion that happiness is a cardinal measurable variable which rises and falls all the time, just like our blood pressure. And second, the correlation between reported feelings and the measurements in the brain also holds strongly across people, which confirms the old claim of economists that you could compare the happiness of different people. So I want to tell you a bit about these findings, many of which are due to the remarkable work of Richard Davidson at Wisconsin, Madison, Wisconsin. The main finding is that positive feelings correspond to brain activity in the left side of the prefrontal cortex, somewhere roughly where I'm pointing here. And negative feelings correspond to brain activity in a similar position on the right side of the brain, all of this being for right-handed people. And to detect the activity, you can use electrodes on the scalp. This is the electroencephalogram, which will measure the electrical activity somewhere inside the skull near the surface. Or, which is more reliable, you can pick up the flow of oxygen in the brain, which is going there to replace the energy which was used up in the electrical activity. That means that you have to get into one of those awful fMRI machines, which will measure what is going on to your oxygen supply. Or slightly less instantaneous, you can use the so-called PET scan, which measures the blood flow by putting a radioactive isotope into it and then seeing the movement of the radioactivity in the brain. All these methods of identifying what is happening inside the brain in the prefrontal area give good correlations between reported feelings and the measurements. And I want to show you an example when people are put into one of these MRI scanners and then shown nice or nasty pictures. Here are the pictures. One picture is nice and one is nasty. I don't know if you can see that unhappy child on the right-hand side. So people are exposed to these pictures and at the same time the MRI scanner is picking up the corresponding change in the oxygen flow in the brain. And the way the computer analyzes this is to record the change in activity as a lighter reddish, yellowish patch. So here you can see that the nice picture has activated the left side of the brain, and the nasty picture has activated the right side of the brain. So here we have objective measurements of how feelings are changing over time inside a person. But I think even more important, we can use these measurements to compare the happiness of different people. Because people differ in the underlying pattern of their brain activity, even when they're at rest. So people whose left side is especially active, you will find, report more positive feelings, more positive memories than people whose right side is more active. And if you take a video, you'll see that the left-siders, let's call them, are smiling more. If you ask their friends, people's friends, is your friend happy or not, people who are left-siders will have friends who say that they are happy, and if they're right-siders, their friends will say that they're not so happy. People who are active on the right side report more negative thoughts, smile less, and are assessed as less happy by their friends, as I said. Quite surprisingly, this approach, this is now using the EEG, works even on newly born babies. They like sucking something sweet. If you give them something sweet, their left forebrain starts humming away. Give them something sour, their right forebrain starts humming away. now comparing different babies, 10 months old, the underlying pattern of brain activity predicts how the baby will respond if its mother disappears for a minute. So babies who are active on the right side start howling the moment mummy goes away, while those on the left side handle the situation much better. And if you go on to 2.5 years old, left-sided youngsters are exploratory and go and find out what the world is like. Right-siders cling to their mummies. Fortunately, there is some change in the ranking of children as time goes by, but this is associated, as I say, with changes equally in the brain measurements. So finally, while we're on this question of measurement, I want to come back to the question of whether negative feelings are just the bottom end of a scale which ends in positive feelings. We had a conference here, which some of us were present, and we discussed this. And the general consensus was, in support of this view, it makes a big difference over how long you measure the feelings. But if you measure the feelings over a short period of time, you will find that they are strongly inversely correlated. And that's true whether you're making comparisons between the same individual in different situations or across different individuals. And it's true whether you're using at least some types of psychological report or measurements on the brain. If you go to measurements over longer periods of time, this correlation between the negative and the positive goes down, and the reason is that the variance of true happiness is, of course, much less over long periods of time, because over short periods of time you're going up and down, but over long periods of time you're more stable, and therefore there's less variation to measure, and the errors in the measurement then start swamping the true measurements. So I think this is still not fully settled area as far as the science is concerned, but I think we can proceed for the time being as though we can think about happiness as a single variable running from extreme joy to extreme misery. And finally, let me mention for skeptics who are only interested in behavior that actually these measurements of happiness are quite well correlated with many measures of physical health, with better immune system responses, and with lower stress-causing cortisol. And they do terrible things, some of these experimenters. They gave flu virus to a group of people, randomly chosen. people who had strong activity in the left forebrain were much less likely to get ill than people who had strong activity in the right forebrain, so watch it. Okay, well, I hope, that's the end of that bit, I hope I persuaded you that there is such a thing as happiness, as Bentham believed. But Bentham, of course, also believed that happiness mattered because it was what people want. And that's the next issue I want to consider. He argued that in the end, all actions are driven by the desire of the individual to feel good. So what does modern psychology say about that? Well, I was going to say psychologists, perhaps I should say most of them, believe two things about this. First, they believe that we are always, often unconsciously, evaluating our situation and the elements in it. We can't help it, we just do it. And second, we're attracted to the favorable elements, and we want to have them, or if we have them, we want to prolong them. And we're repelled by the unfavorable elements, and we try to avoid them, or try to stop them, if they're continuing. And psychologists call these two phenomena approach and avoidance. Now, I think this is very fundamental stuff, this, and I think it's easy to see why evolution would have selected people who behaved like this. Because first we're appraising things in terms, obviously, of their contribution to what we consider to be our good. So we're liking things which are good for our survival, and then we're seeking to have the things we like, and that's how we survive. Let me just illustrate these two propositions from two ingenious experiments of somebody called John Barg. I don't know if you like psychological experiments. It's a peculiar genre. But let me describe these experiments because I think they're rather interesting. And his technique is to flash up good or bad words on a screen and then see how people respond. So in the first experiment that I'm going to report, he flashed the words up subliminally so they people couldn't actually see them at all. But he recorded the impact of these words. There were some of them happy and some of them wretched words on the subject's mood. And if the words that were being flashed up were nice words, the mood went up. And if the words were bad words, the mood went down, even though the person wasn't conscious of seeing the words at all, which shows, this illustrates this very passive evaluation process which is going on consciously and unconsciously all the time. But he next went on to this question of approach and avoidance by making the words on the screen legible. And the experiment was that the subject then had to remove the word. The words go up one by one, and the subject has to remove each word from the screen with the aid of a lever. Now, for the first group of subjects, that means people, if you didn't know, for the first group of people, the words were to be removed in what's the natural way, which is to pull the good words, approach, and to push the bad words, avoidance. But then there was another group of people who were told to do the thing the other way, and the lever was reprogrammed, so that to remove the bad words, they had to pull them, which is a very unnatural thing to do, and to remove the good words, which they would like to pull towards them, they had to push them. And the second group were just much less effective at removing the words from the screen than the first group. I think it's interesting. So the conclusion of all this is that there is an evaluative faculty in all of us which is telling us how happy we are and directing our attention towards things which would improve our happiness. And from the various possibilities open to us, we choose whichever combination of activities will make us feel best. Well, that sounds awfully like what economists say. Not a surprise. And it's often said to be vacuous, this statement. Of course, it's not vacuous at all, because it means quite specifically that if I like A and I like B, and the cost of A in terms of B goes up, I'm going to choose less A and more B. That's the standard law of demand, which is confirmed throughout human life, an incredible number of applications. It's confirmed in rats, and it's probably true of most living things, all of which have a tendency to pursue their end good as best they can and behave differently if the alternatives facing them change. And obviously in lower animals the process is unconscious, and even in humans it's mainly unconscious, because the conscious brain couldn't possibly handle most of the problem. But we do have this huge bulge at the front, which other mammals lack. And that is where the conscious part of the balancing operation is being performed. So this psychological model, of course, is very much like the one that economists have used from Adam Smith onwards. We want to be happy and we act to promote our happiness given the possibilities open to us, with, of course, lots and lots of exceptions. Some types of behavior that people want are bad for them. Anorexia is bad for you, so is smoking. People are often short-sighted. They don't forecast their future feelings very well, and natural selection has not produced perfect psyches. But of course, nor has it produced perfect bodies. It's quite obvious that in some sense we were selected to be healthy, and we are healthy an awful lot of the time, but we often get sick. And in exactly the same way, I'm arguing we were selected to feel good, and it would be impossible to explain human behavior and human survival except by the notion that we want to feel good and try to do things that help us to feel it. Okay, let me move on to the outcome of this process. Well, it's good in parts, isn't it? In the standard economic model, private actions and exchanges get us to a situation, a Pareto optimum, where no one could be happier without someone else being less happy. And then we say, well, there are the problems of information, foresight, externality, economies of scale, which require some collective action for the efficient solution to arise. But broadly speaking, the economic model says, I'm going back to where I started, it sort of says that the higher the real wage, the happier the population, with a few little reservations. And it's very important to understand precisely what is wrong with the model. That what is wrong with the model, it assumes what I think I called earlier on in Robin's language, given ends, we would call it now, constant tastes, constant norms, etc. It fails to realize, the economic model fails to realize, that our wants, once we're above subsistence level, are largely derived from society, and that what comes from society are major factors which affect our happiness. To a large extent, we want things and experiences because other people have them. We're also products of our education and the moral values which we inherit. And we live in communities which can be more peaceful or more trusting or less so. All of these outside influences come at us just directly. They don't come through contractual arrangements, which is the way in which economists think of the influences bearing upon them, the terms on which the contracts can be made, and then the outcome of the contracts which they make. They don't come that way at all. Now, if these social influences were unaffected by economic policy and by economic ideology, we could think of economic policy in one compartment. Let's get as rich as we can. It may not be very helpful, but let's just get on with it. And we could think of social policy in another. But unfortunately, and this perhaps is the one of the most important points I want to make, the world isn't like that. And rational policy requires, therefore, that we simultaneously use many disciplines to understand how a policy will affect happiness through the various different channels, of which GDP is only one. This is a pretty obvious methodological point, but the one fact which makes it essential is the one that we started with, that people have got no happier in the last 50 years. They've become much richer, they work less, at least in this country. They have longer holidays, they travel more, they live longer, and they are healthier, but they are no happier. And I think this is a really shocking fact which should make us all rethink many of our assumptions and should be the starting point for a new wave of social science. So let me spend the rest of the lecture trying to establish this fact. Please wave if you can't hear me. Any wavers? Okay, I'll speak up. Right. For the United States, the General Social Survey has asked the following question since the early 1970s. Taken altogether, how would you say things are these days? Would you say that you're very happy, pretty happy, or not too happy? And here are some answers. As you can see, the distribution of happiness has practically changed. It's practically unchanged. Now, before the early 70s, a similar question was asked by the Gallup organization, and in this figure, I've linked the two series together to show what proportion of people were very happy throughout the post-war period. As you can see, the proportion of people who said they were very happy rose in the 50s, fell in the 60s, and have been fairly stable since. And the contrast with the GDP per head figures is striking. For Japan, the figures on happiness also available on a continuous basis since 1950. They show no change in happiness, despite a six-fold rise in income per head. In Europe, the series collected by Eurobarometer began in the early 1970s. Again, there's been no increase in happiness at the European level. If we look at individual countries, there's also been no rise except in Denmark and Italy. These findings are all the more surprising, since at any time in any community, there is a clear relation between happiness and income. This is shown in this table. As you can see, the people who are in the top quarter of the income distribution tend to be substantially happier than the people in the bottom quarter of the income distribution, and that is in 1975. So you'd expect that when the people in the bottom quarter had become richer, as they had by 1998, they would have also become happier. But they hadn't, nor had the people in the top quarter. The graph looks exactly the same in 1998. So you can begin to guess the kinds of explanation I'm going to be offering in the next lecture. But first, let us test these facts. The sceptical reaction, of course, is to say, well, people have simply shifted upward the standard of happiness which they're identifying as very happy. Their expectations of happiness have risen, so although they are truly happier, they don't report themselves as such, something like that. And I want to give two technical and two substantive reasons for not believing that this is the explanation of what's going on. First, these are technical explanations. The European survey data also tell us whether people are satisfied with their life. Now, the word satisfied is slightly more relativistic than the word happy. So if rising expectations are distorting the reported trends of happiness in a downward direction, you'd think they'd be doing it even more in the case of satisfaction. But the trends in satisfaction are the same as those in happiness. Here's a second technical point. If people now expect to be happier than people used to be in the past, you'd expect the biggest changes in expected happiness to occur between cohorts rather than within cohorts. Yet actually the same people within any one cohort, although they're getting much richer over their lifetime, experience no increase in happiness. So those are the technical arguments, but the main reasons for believing that this is a real finding, the main additional reasons that I want to give you, are first that the same finding comes out of the cross-section of countries, and the second is the rise over time in depression and crime. So let's start with the cross-section of countries. In this graph, income is on the horizontal axis, and on the vertical axis is happiness. It's measured by the average of two numbers, the percentage happy and the percentage satisfied with their life. And as the graph shows, once a country has reached over about $15,000 a head, there's absolutely no relation between the income per head along here and the happiness measured up there. However, for poorer countries, there is a clear impact of income on happiness. If you look, for example, at India, which is here, or China, which is here, Pakistan, Bangladesh, these are less happy countries than the group of rich countries. And it's also a fact that within poor countries for which we have time series, the level of happiness has increased as their real incomes have risen. That's for India, Mexico, and the Philippines. So it is the case, and I want to stress this, that if you're near the breadline, the absolute income really matters. But once you're at this sort of level here, the fact that there's no relation between income and happiness across countries, I think, tends to support the finding we had earlier, that there's no relation over time either, as countries become happier. Just a brief comment on the politics. Of course, this group down here are all the countries from the former Soviet Empire. The dates here are either 1990 or 1995. And of course, a striking finding is how politics matter. Oppression, as well as poverty, can degrade the human condition. And at the height of communism, the Russians were among the most miserable people on earth, and they have become even less happy in the difficulties of the transition period. Let me say a word about language. You could ask the question, does the word happy mean the same in the different languages used in these countries here? Because if it does mean something different, we can't learn anything. First point, for many of these countries, you've got three measures: how happy people are, how satisfied they are, and what score they give to life, using a scale running from the worst possible life to the best. And the ranking is very, very close on all these three measures, which suggests that perhaps the words are not a problem. But there's also evidence from rather interesting study done in the most obvious way, which is when you ask the same people question in two languages, preferably languages as far apart as possible, and a rather enterprising postgraduate student did this with some Chinese students who were also able to speak English. And they were asked the question in both languages with 2 weeks apart. And they reported almost exactly the same distribution of happiness in both languages, and the answers in the two languages were extremely highly correlated. Equally, you can take those people who live in Switzerland but speak the same language as people across the border, and you will find that all the Swiss people speaking different languages are fairly similar in their happiness, and they're all happier than the people living across the border. So this is some evidence that the language is not a huge problem. So I would say that comparing countries does confirm, roughly speaking, what history also shows: no relation among the richer countries between trends in income and trends in happiness. But in any case, we have other time series measures, and this is the last point that I want to make. We have other time series measures of well-being, especially at the bottom end of the tail of happiness, because we have the evidence of increased depression, alcoholism, and crime. Most of the evidence suggests that clinical depression has increased since the Second World War. And by clinical depression, I don't mean the spells of blues that we all experience. I mean a very well-defined psychiatric condition in which individuals can't perform their normal social roles for at least some weeks. And to assess the prevalence of depression, we rely on interview surveys where people report their experience in reply to a whole battery of questions, which are then diagnosed by specialists. And in the US, roughly 14% of people aged 35 have already experienced a depression. Many who've experienced it have experienced more than one, of course. And the main evidence of an increase comes from comparing information from people now aged 35 with the memories of people who were 35 some years earlier. If you take Americans who reached 35 in the 1950s, believe it or not, only 2% had experienced depression by that age, according to this survey. And now it's 14%. And what is striking is that this recorded depression increased mainly in the golden period of economic growth in the decades after the Second World War, even at a time, if I may point this out, when inequality was being reduced. Similar increases are found in most countries where the data exist, though there is, of course, considerable controversy over the magnitude of the increase and even some question whether there's an increase, but nobody suggests that there has been a decrease in depression over the period, despite the huge reduction in absolute poverty. Suicide data people often ask about, but I think they're less relevant since only about 1% of people end their lives that way. It's the extreme. But suicide has actually increased somewhat in most advanced countries except US, Britain, Sweden and Switzerland. And youth suicide has increased almost everywhere. I won't dwell either on drug abuse, which I think is partly increasing because of easier access, or has increased due to easier access to the countries which supply the drugs. But I do want to say something about alcohol addiction, because I think it's a very meaningful indicator of unhappiness, and the history of it is, if I can put it that way, rather sobering. In the first quarter of the 20th century, alcohol consumption fell in many countries despite economic growth, so it's not just a straight factor, a feature of economic growth. And in the second quarter of the 20th century, it stayed roughly constant. Since 1950 or so, alcohol consumption has soared in every country except France, which still consumes more than anybody else. And much of the drinking gives rise to problems. In the US, over a quarter of young white men say they have experienced problems with alcohol. And this compares with under 15% of older men, people of 65 or above, who say that they've ever experienced such problems. So this is fairly hard evidence, but I suppose the hardest evidence is the simple medical evidence of deaths from cirrhosis, which are up in every country except France. And finally, there's crime, where you have a very similar story to alcoholism. In most advanced countries, crime fell in the years before the First World War, again in the opposite direction to economic growth. Then crime was fairly stable between the wars, and some of us can remember the time when it was forecast that crime must come down further as poverty is eliminated and full employment established. Never was a forecast by social scientists so completely wrong. Exactly the opposite happened. As full employment came in, as poverty was eliminated, so crime soared. In most countries, the criminal statistics increased by a factor of about 5 between 1950 and 1980, which is a truly astonishing increase, even if you disallow some of the reporting bias. Japan was the only country where this didn't happen. And now in Britain, a third of all young men have been convicted of a crime by the time they're 30. Well, if you have that degree of alienation, it's not surprising that the overall happiness figures are confirming no increase in happiness. So, what is going on? Well, that's the next lecture. And in that lecture, I'll try and give some answers and then discuss what policies could lead in a better direction. And I'm going to be focusing on this question of the trade-off between economic affluence on the one side and the costs which might result from policies to produce affluence on the other. Finally, let me just summarize what I've said. First, I've argued that rational policymaking is possible. I would call it the most rational policymaking is possible, since happiness is a real phenomenon and can be measured and compared between people. We're at the beginning of developing our ability to do this, but we can already see the way ahead. Second, I've argued that happiness is basic to human motivation, even though, of course, we sometimes do the wrong thing. And third, we found, and I hope I've persuaded you, that happiness has not increased in the last 50 years. However, we should not be depressed, because I do believe that we live in the happiest society, in a society that is as happy as any that has ever existed, but I just think it would be better if we could be happier still, and especially if the least happy people could be happier still, and that's what I want to discuss in the next two lectures. Thank you.
Richard, thank you very much, and well done leaving us with that trailer, that taster for tomorrow, when more will be revealed, just like a good soap opera. Now then, we have a bit of time for questions. There are some people with roving mics. I'm told that they're roving both in the gallery and on the ground floor. So if you want to ask a question, please put up your hand and a mic will make its way to you. Is there someone at
the back?
Well, let's try out the back first. Yes, pass along to there.
It sounds like a lot of what you're talking about depends on objective measures of happiness, and I see two potential problems with that. One is that if we reduce happiness to mere measuring of neurotransmitters or some sort of brain activity, it doesn't take an take into account the sources of what's causing that happiness, and B, it doesn't preclude the kind of remedial measure of stimulating artificially these chemicals. Should I move? I'll move. Okay. Do you see? I'm saying if somebody takes great pleasure chemically from doing something that's horribly evil, there's no way that that this as a measure of happiness can account for that and discount that. And secondly, there's the classic, you know, Aldous Huxley 1984 rebuttal. Why not just administer soma to all those people who are suffering in whatever in nations that are plagued by unhappiness as we measure it?
Well, they're both very good questions. I know a lot of people who would like to have some soma if it could be discovered. I don't think one should consider it a joke. I think that, in fact, probably the greatest improvement in or greatest alleviation of human misery in our society in the last 50 years has come through the development of psychiatric drugs, and people who lived in torment are not now living in torment who would have done. It's a very, very important issue. I do want to discuss it a bit more in my last lecture, and thank you for raising that issue. I mean, on the question of measurement, perhaps I didn't make clear the spirit in which I was going on and on about measurement. I was going on about it because most people will say, if you say you think it's a good idea to try and make people as happy as possible, that it's a completely evanescent concept, and that it's not something that has any existence. I'm wanting to say first that if we can measure something which corresponds to something that people say that they feel deeply about, it can't be poo-pooed in the way which it could be when nobody could measure anything that two or three different people could look at and say, yes, that's the measurement. So that's why I'm stressing the measurement. Of course, if we wanted to have a complete social science that really was trying to advance the greatest happiness, which I think we should, we would want to measure it, but it's not clear that we'd want to measure it then in the brain. If we thought we could believe what people said, we could be quite happy measuring it that way, but we ought to learn a very great deal more about what you said, namely what is causing the phenomenon that people are reporting.
Now, in an attempt to maximize happiness, I'm going to move down here. Would you mind saying, when you ask questions, who you are?
Yeah. My name's Gordon Heald, and I ran the Gallup organization here and did a lot of happiness surveys, if I may say, last 25 years. It's not only declined, it's gone down quite drastically. In 1952, I think 42% said they were very happy. In the year 2000, it dropped to 29%. So it's quite a dramatic decline in happiness, which we have to monitor. The other interesting thing, there's remarkable differences between countries. And the happiest country in Europe for a long time was Ireland. And they were fairly low on income, etc. And we did a press conference in Dublin to present the results. And we read the local press that said, we're happy, healthy, and holy. And on the same page, it had seven murders, man rapes, one, etc. So something's all relative. We then did a large analysis of 20 countries in 1980. And we found the biggest single factor affecting happiness was one which you haven't mentioned tonight, was satisfaction with family life. And that was by far the most dominating factor, went above everything else. I enjoyed your graph of the economics showing that after a while, once you get to a certain level of money, you're quite happy. And broadly, there aren't very rich people are not very happy, is what we found as well. But it's the satisfaction with family life is a key variable we found. Anyway, thank you.
No, well, I mean, thank you for trailing my third lecture. I'm absolutely I'm going to try and discuss all the factors, but I would put a few more others as well.
Now, there's more clamour down here than there is up there at the moment. This gentleman here, yep.
Robert Taylor, Centre for Economic Performance. I'd like to turn to that table we had on sex, because it may be a purely subjective observation on my part, but if people regard sex as their greatest happiness, you might have expected that people are getting more of it now than they were 30 or 40 years ago. So perhaps it isn't necessarily the best criteria, or maybe that people's views of what good sex is has changed in the last 30 years, and then people are rather more choosy, or rather more higher expectations. And that would perhaps go for the other phenomenon, which is, I think, is a dinner, I see, in dinner and lunch. Of course, I was brought up in the days of rationing and food subsidies and National Health orange juice. I mean, these days, most people have an extraordinary variety of food to eat. And if that is a factor in explaining their happiness, then there's more sex and there's better food. So why aren't people more happy? Perhaps those aren't necessarily the best criteria of judging what's happened.
Very easy, actually. Happiness is the weighted average of your happiness in all the activities. And what fraction of their time do you think these women spent in sex? The average was 2%.
Malcolm Dean up on the balcony.
Richard, could you tell us why you think Denmark and Italy are much happier places? Was there anything in your studies which showed that we could learn lessons from?
Well, no, I think the point that Gordon made just now, I mean, we need much more systematic comparative study, and it's not been done, dare I say it, in the perfect system. We try to explain, say, unemployment differences between countries, and it needs to be done very systematically. And it's not only the differences in trends, but of course the differences in levels, both.
Down here.
Hello, Richard Bronk in LSE. How far do you think that happiness is also a normative concept, as well as something you can positively measure, and that when we ascribe it either to ourselves or to others, we have in mind some normative frames of reference, self-esteem, how authentic the experience is, and something more close to the sort of Aristotelian conception of actually living up to our potentials. And this might account for why sort of drug-induced euphoria wouldn't necessarily count as happiness to most people. And particularly with relevance to measuring brain impulses, I mean, it seems to me that this may be an area of problem.
Well, you see, this is what, as you say, Aristotle was after and John Stuart Mill, that somehow some form, some things which make you feel the same quantity of happiness are better than others. And my answer to that is, isn't the real issue how long they make you feel happy? And drugs actually don't even make druggies feel happy for very long. So I think it's always, the argument against the Benthamite view has always been to pick on rather short-lived experiences and saying, surely you don't think that's how people should live. No Benthamite, sensible Benthamite, ever thought people should live on short-term highs. Never. So my own view is that there are, of course, many, many, many factors that contribute to a person's sense of happiness, and self-esteem is a very, very important one, and self-esteem is quite closely connected with the relation between, as it were, your achievement and the norm against which you're measuring it. All of this is a very sensitive mechanism. But what I've been trying to talk about today is the result of the mechanism. Is there, and as I believe, an ultimate, as it were, output of the system, which is how the person feels. And tomorrow and the next day, we have to try and explain how the inputs work in producing the feeling.
Blue shirt in the front of the balcony.
Yeah. My name is Dahlia Litchfield. I'm a planner, planning happiness. You described the measures of happiness as what I would call snapshots or static situations. Are you having sex at this moment? Has your salary been X yesterday or X plus two? Isn't there perhaps some merit in looking at the process that people are through rather than the static situations. For example, if you have a ladder and someone is standing on the lower rank of the ladder and is climbing up, there is excitement, there's happiness. If you've reached the top of the ladder, you've got nowhere to go. There isn't the excitement of going towards. In fact, there's a greater risk of falling down or reducing your position. I would say it's a different way of looking at measurement, which may be very significant.
I think these are important points. These are factors which contribute to happiness. I think there would be very few people who are... let me use the word authentic happiness, which is used by Seligman in a recent book, authentically happy, who didn't have some goals and didn't have the means and anticipation of achieving those goals. This is a very important part of the mechanism. If the goals are too far away and they can't be achieved, that brings about disaster. If there are no goals, that probably brings about deflation also. So the mechanisms are very, very subtle. I completely agree with you, but that doesn't detract from the end point of the experience, which I was trying to talk about today.
Dan here.
Well, now after you said all that, I start to wonder, isn't it...
You just say who you are.
Oh, Stéphane Collignon from the LSE. Isn't it in a way, you say it's not the high, it's not the low, so it must be the mean. So really, isn't happiness, the way you use it, the expected utility of the events that we have?
Well, average utility. As experienced utility is what we're interested in. We're not interested in the anticipated expected utility. This has unfortunately got muddled in economics. Maybe that which explains the choice, but it's not that that we consider to be the outcome which we are concerned with.
Lady over here. Yep, in white.
My name's Michelle. I'm actually from Cambridge, not the OC. But I really liked your lecture, and especially at the end when you said if we could just make the least happy people a little happier, that would be really nice. And I was just thinking, do we have a moral duty to try to make the least happy people happier because they're so disempowered, presumably? And if we do have that moral duty, do we have a moral duty to research your funding so we can find out who they are and things like that?
Sorry, I didn't catch the last...
I was just wondering, you know, if there's a moral duty to make the least happy people.
Well, you see, what I want to do at the end, I believe that Bentham's formulation of what is good was correct, which is what is good is what maximizes the happiness of everybody. And I want at the end of my third lecture to justify that. And of course, to the extent that it's easier to make the less happy people happier, it would lead to a focus on that. But this is one of the big issues, of course, as to whether you accept the Benthamite adding up approach, in which gains in happiness count equally regardless of the starting point. And we can discuss that a bit when I make my pitch for utilitarianism in the third lecture.
It's just about there.
Max Steuer, London School of Economics. Richard, in the early part of your lecture, you suggested that the happiness mechanism was an evolved mechanism that led to survival and was a control mechanism. And if that's correct, then any control mechanism has to return to neutral. If it stays stuck at any one point, it can't function anymore as a control mechanism. So the evolutionary view of happiness would clearly predict that when people report at the surface level, for example, I asked former colleagues who unfortunately were in concentration camps what it was like, and they say, well, there were good days and bad days. But in a deeper sense, not related to instantaneous decision making, I think there is where it's difficult to get an answer. Certainly one can't do it through brain imaging or asking people, because that, as has been suggested in other contexts, is a sort of kind of instantaneous sort of thing, or nearly so. But I think that if you accept your evolutionary view, then returning to zero would be part of it, but not play quite the evaluating role that you're suggesting.
Well, I'm not sure what you're suggesting. There is, of course, this sort of homeostatic view that everybody has a set point of happiness, and basically they'll always come back to it, whatever the situation. I don't think there's any more reason to suppose that or justify it in an evolutionary context than the notion that there's a homeostatic level of health. I mean, we can become healthier. We become healthier. Why shouldn't we become happier?
Yeah, back there.
In the Muriel Nissel, who in a past existence has done quite a lot of work on social indicators, is there not evidence to suggest that inequality in society, income equality, is correlated with happiness? The figures you quoted so far have been average GDP country per country. What about inequality within a society?
Well, of course, there's the long-standing economic view that the marginal utility of income declines, in which case, if you had a more concentrated distribution of income, it would raise the people at the bottom by more than it reduced the people at the top, and you'd have a higher average. And I think that I've always thought that's a very powerful argument in favor of redistribution. As regards the evidence other than that indirect evidence, and there's quite a lot of evidence of diminishing marginal utility, which I'll refer to later, but as regards the sort of gross evidence, you know, from comparing societies and so on, I think it's a little too difficult to pick that up. Nobody has successfully picked it up when they put in other factors. I'll report in my last lecture a very good study by John Helliwell of across national, using the World Value Survey. He couldn't pick up an equality effect, but I don't mean to say it's not there, but it's difficult to see it sort of jumping out of some of the numbers.
There was, yes, down there, please.
I'm Nicole Stefanidou from the LSE, and thank you for your lecture. You talked about feelings. You talk about good feelings and bad feelings and reactions of people to positive words and negative words and even the brain reaction. And I was wondering whether we should consider happiness as a broader, in a broader sense, not just in terms of feelings. Because just because people may have fun, that doesn't mean they're happy. And plus, the brain reactions, this is nothing. I mean, it could change. It's subject to change. And the same people who had a positive reaction to something during the experiment, they may have a negative reaction next day because they had a bad day or because they woke up in a bad mood. So I was wondering how we can rely on all these results, and how can we say that just because people feel good or bad, they're happy or unhappy.
Well, of course, as far as experiments are concerned, you're always dealing with sort of average effects. It doesn't mean to say that the effect is the same for everybody, but there's a tendency in one direction or another. But I'm not sure that I completely understood your basic question, or whether you're questioning whether happiness exists, or whether you're saying that people are not reporting it correctly.
No, sorry.
No. Remarkably consistent as a measure. You go to certain groups, and remarkably, you may vary day by day. But when you do the measurement, like I'm watching my feet, and you find roughly the same all the time. Your happiness is almost predictive of rage, laugh, everything else. It's
okay.
Now, Gordon, I think we have
to
restrict the debate down here, particularly if you don't have a mic. We've time for two more questions. I'm going to pick one from the gallery. It's the lady in the middle with her hand up, and then I'll pick you down here.
Hi, Elizabeth Hayden-Jones, just happy person, I think. I'm wondering where you think the role of perceived opportunity, specifically within a certain age range, I'm thinking mostly 35 and under is the somewhat passe term, I guess, of Generation X, Prozac generation, MTV generation, whatever you want to call us, and the relationship of having increased opportunity or perceived opportunity slash choice, and yet seemingly being described as a more depressed generation because of this, and if that is feeds into this gross domestic product rate increasing and our happiness decreasing, what you might think. Thank you.
Well, there have been very interesting experiments by psychologists on whether more choice necessarily makes people happier. There's a psychologist called Barry Schwartz who offered people the opportunity of choosing from 6 jams or 26 jams. And they all preferred the opportunity of choosing from 6 rather than from 26 at the same price. So I do think this is an important point. I mean, he teaches at Swarthmore, and he informed me that Swarthmore is full of rich, brilliant people who could do almost anything they wanted, and they're all unhappy because they don't know what to do. And I think that this is a genuine issue, that the choice set, the proposition of economics, that the wider the choice set, the happier the person must be, is not straightforwardly true. You need to have some guidance, some inner guidance that is leading you to feel that there's some part of it which is what is you. And he told me the fundamental problem with these Swarthmore ladies is that they could succeed at everything, but they feel it is so important to succeed that they can't succeed in deciding how to succeed.
And there last question was the one over there, yeah.
I'm Steve Banks, I'm a former student at LSE. Thank you for your lecture, it's very interesting. I was wondering, in terms of the psychological theories that you've been using, have you used the humanistic psychologies and particularly now the integrative psychologies, and I'm thinking particularly of Maslow and his hierarchy of needs? That's one question, and another one which is follows from that is that there's now this integration going on between psychology, Western developmental psychology, and Eastern, the mystical traditions. And mystical philosophers down the ages have pointed out that the world comes in opposites. We have inside and out, you have convex and concave, you have hot and cold, and you have happiness and unhappiness. And that they're like, or you have buying and selling, that you can't have buying without selling, you can't have inside without out, and also they say you can't have happiness without unhappiness, and that the goal for a human being is actually liberation, in what they call liberation from the pairs. So I just wondered if that's kind of surfaced in your research and in your thinking.
Well, on the question of Maslow, I was present when I think Felicia Huppert here was chairing the lecture by Martin Seligman, who wrote this book I called Authentic Happiness. And he was asked precisely this question, where is Maslow in all this? To which his answer was, well, Maslow was basically right. The only thing is he did no research, and he couldn't prove that he was right. So this is certainly a development of this line of thought. And there's a sort of new movement in psychology called positive psychology, which is an attempt to get away from just the study of the depth, but also to study the normal range of experience, which is led by people like Seligman, who think of themselves as, I think, building on Maslow, but on a proper research base. As regards mysticism, let me tell you a fact first. The neuroscientist who whose work I put on the screen was rung up 10 years ago by the office of the Dalai Lama and was invited out for a week's sort of seminar or something, brainstorming. And he became very struck with the Dalai Lama, and he's become a meditator, but he has analyzed the brainwaves of many of the monks that he's got to know through the Dalai Lama, And there's a sort of normal bell curve, you know, of these brain measurements as of anything else in life. the monk which he analyzed most closely is at 4 standard deviations to the to the right in terms of happiness. And you, as you know, you don't normally get 4 standard deviations coming up on the screen. But I would call that happiness. I wouldn't call it liberation from these frightful pairs. I would call it getting out to the right-hand end of the distribution.
Well, now my job is to promote unhappiness in two ways. First, by saying I think we've reached almost the end of the questions. Unless, Lord Rowe, do you want to ask a question? Yes, I think you're an exception. Just wait for the microphone, though, if you don't. The microphone's in.
I think Richard Laird will remember this better than I do. But I think the late Joseph Stalin said that the greatest happiness was to go to bed in the evening knowing that you had eliminated an enemy during the day.
Very good.
I think that's... That's the perfect note on which to end. Thank you, Richard, very much. I'm to tell those who are going to the reception that they should all go where, Richard? Could you remember? Just follow Richard, basically.
Fifth floor.
The fifth floor.
Yeah.
And those of you who are excluded, don't be unhappy. Come back tomorrow instead. Thank you again very much.